just disappears.
Is that a useless person? Or not.
I'm just being clumsy.
And who listens to me?
Nobody. That's why there's no, you don't have to feel embarrassed about saying anything. Yeah.
Them and listen to them.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody
listens. Don't worry,
all
your secrets are safe with me.
So anyway, I sent Jeff an interesting article this morning. It was in the New York Times. And it basically talked about things that Jeff and you all talk about all the time. But what was really interesting about it was that it was written by a neuroscientist. And his basic theory is called attention schema theory.
Attention schema?
Schema.
Attention schema, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was attention seeking theory. I'm like, that sounds accurate.
Schema theory. And basically what he said, and again, this is not very different.
Hey, hello there.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Decaf for Jeff.
I appreciate it.
I would just like a water with lemon.
Or lemon?
Regular.
Regular? Water in L.A.
Yeah.
Water. I think this is Amsterdam.
Decaf. So anyway, the name of the article is "Are We Really Conscious?" And so the attention schema is about attention as kind of a physical phenomenon, but awareness is a mental construct. So we observe, see things, and our mind actually takes in all of the data, and then it has its own way of modeling it. And part of the model is... Part of the model is that there is a me, and that the me has a relationship to the phenomenon. So basically what he's saying is that we are really not conscious. We construct our consciousness. We construct awareness. And now this is, I guess, I don't like to call it Jeff New Agey, but, you know, it's mostly sort of New Agey people that espouse things like this. Although, I have to say, in a lot of my studies of Buddhism, there is discussion of this kind of thing, that we really do construct our own reality. We create our own world. So this is a neuroscientist basically supporting this with research. Is that accurate? I mean, in terms of the
I
article,
believe everybody.
In terms of the article, but I didn't believe it.
The words get. We have to be careful with the words that are used to refer to what reality is or isn't. So it may be that he's using the word conscious to suggest self, and in Buddhism, and now in the discernments of neurobiologists, they're seeing like, whoa, this is an impersonally and spontaneously arising plasma that defies any, right, confidence in mechanism, and that the sense of I is borrowed from what this actually is, were it something. And just like, you know, the Buddha was quite articulate, right? There's neither I nor mine. And so in the Vipassana tradition, right, the deliberate dematerialization and decoupling of self with phenomena is deliberate. it's specifically deliberate. So in the Vipassana training process, the insight process is, am I body? Clearly not body. Am I mind? Clearly not mind. Right? Am I feelings, emotions, and sensations? No, clearly not. And so the agenda then turns what we're calling awareness or attention, and who knows how to, what, you know, how to draw the lines between anything. But awareness and attention has the capacity, let's say, through the vehicle, the great vehicle of whether you want to go Hinayana, Mahayana, you know, Vipassana, Zen, etc., etc. But through any of these vehicles, attention and awareness has the capacity, has the, we call it inherent intelligence, to decouple from the myth of self. So yeah, it's that's always kind of been New Agey, but maybe peripherally so. That these, let's call it well-respected practitioners in the field of science, are using empirical observation of biologic systems to come to the same revelation is sweet. Not self. What we have here is not self. It's a little clumsy to, let's say, use the word conscious and to suggest we're not conscious.
Yeah, it's all about definition.
Right. And that's why, you know, you line up these various words like, you know, ducks at the shooting gallery, and it, you know, you just take them all down. Because they don't, what could any, what does any word refer to other than the irrefutable nature of what is so? But that doesn't mean I know what's so. This is irrefutable, but what does that tell me? Nothing. Awareness, so. Consciousness, so. The absolute, so. Duality, so. Non-duality, so. Right? Where do you place your confidence? If you place your confidence in any kind of representational exhortation, that's clearly empty. Our confidence, our vitality, that we are alive and bump up against each other, hopefully in nice ways, pleasing ways, that's the reality. Where what thought does with this miracle, irrefutable miracle, is kind of its problem, its business.
You know, one thing that's interesting about the article, that towards the end, he asked the question, why does the brain bother to construct this model?
Right.
And he says, well, it has great value because in constructing the model for itself, the subjectivity, also we are able, the brain is able to construct the model of other, and that's the value, is trying to control the environment by understanding your own brain, your own model, you're assuming that other has the same construct, and therefore you can interact with some security.
But that's, isn't that an arbitrary apology for what this is or isn't? Completely. I mean, some guy says, oh, I found the value as to why the... And what's the brain? The brain isn't doing this. Even the brain, even the fatty tissue, even the synaptic leap, right, from neuron to neuron, is being done by what? The brain? How can the brain be responsible for what we call the presence of the brain? So the brain isn't doing what we would like to hold it responsible for. It's not.
The chicken and the egg.
Fair enough.
He's saying the brain is
dead. Well, see, these guys, I mean, the physicists, they're not ready to leap off the mystic cliff.
Right.
They're getting close.
They're starting,
I mean,
they say, we're starting here.
Yeah, they're getting close to leaping off the mystic cliff. But before they do, they always trip themselves up by having to hold something responsible for something, which therefore conducts something, and therefore I assign an arbitrary value to that as to why life on Earth looks the way life on Earth looks. But within his own model, he should have the cojones to see that that's another, right, fabrication. So the mystic probably goes in kicking and screaming, right? But when the mystic goes off the cliff, then Okay. What? Does this need value? Does it need arbitration? Does it need justification? Does it need science or yogis or shamans or police to conduct themselves from the vantage point of authority?
Well, in our conventional reality, the answer is yes.
It does appear.
Okay, how about
right?
For
do they
people
need?
Like that.
Do
like
they
that.
Need it?
No, but people like this.
Shit happens. Right? Shit happens.
I told you not to get used to it.
Damn it. Are we back to old school now?
Sorry, I can't afford
which
it anyway.
Love.
What I'm going to do is potatoes. I got potatoes and onion in the oven. I have mushroom and pepper in the oven. And I can do, like, eggs separate. And can I do
whatever you want.
Good idea.
Good idea.
We trust you.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
Do you scramble? Is that okay? If everybody wants scramble, or do you want, like,
I'm good with whatever.
I always get scramble.
Scramble good?
Eggs.
Okay. You're in trouble then. I don't know what.
But are the potatoes?
Oh,
and the,
potatoes and peppers.
Are the vegetables with butter or oil?
Olive oil.
I can eat that and toast.
Okay.
With no butter.
Okay, I'm gonna put naans out, toast. I'm gonna the vegetables.
And some
bacon.
Bacon.
Okay. Then I put bacon, ham. Okay.
You're putting all this in scrambled eggs.
No, he just, like, puts it out,
no,
like, kind of family style, and we all share whatever.
Are you going to put cheese in
it? And it's, like,
no.
12 or 13 bucks
no.
or something. I don't know.
When you're on, so I'll bring you a gold from the side.
Great, thank you. Thank you.
Do you eat everything, or do you have
any? Is everybody else doing everything?
Yeah.
I'm doing everything.
Get in line with the rest of the sheep.
It's not a habit you're with.
What did you get
out of it? Get in line with the sheep.
The vitality of all of this investigation is not about what's true. Though if I'm a pundit, if I'm a seeker, if I'm an aspiring Buddhist, then maybe I think I want to find out what's true. But what if nothing's true? Well, that doesn't mean there's no truth. What if nothing's true? That doesn't mean there's no truth. It just means that the interest, habit, or investment in representational living, which is the bane of what we call I, me, my, just empties out of your soul. Now, that doesn't mean you become fig jelly in the corner. You're still as profoundly functional within the myth as we've always been. I mean, your commitment, your will, your intentionality, your this is all attached to a steering wheel which is attached to nothing. So all of this blatant exposition and drama of self is just turning a steering wheel that's attached to nothing. It's total myth. And so functioning, whether functionally or dysfunctionally, still goes on. But if there's something that changes, it would be that in you, meaning your experience, the sovereignty of you, there is no longer any Velcro or attachment or presumption to live referentially. That's it. That's enlightenment. That's what the Buddha was sitting on. That was the stone he was sitting on under the Bodhi tree. Holy fuck, he said to himself in Pali or Sanskrit or whatever. This is absolutely non-referential. I never would have guessed. And from that simple observation came the Pali canon, the monks and the nuns, you know? What was the point of it all? This proliferates, doesn't it? Doesn't it? It proliferates on a dime.
But here's my basic, I said, two streams of thought.
Yeah.
This is the one that I grapple with, is I agree with your assessment of what the Buddha realized.
Cool.
But I think he also realized, or also wanted to bring this conception down to another level to help people live in the most successful or way of living without suffering.
He failed.
Tried to make it, well,
he failed.
He wanted to bring it to a practical level. And I think what the middle way is he took his understanding and integrated it with conventional wisdom and tried to come up with a way to help people live in a practical way. So I agree with all your discussions and the way things really are, but what about the fact that unless we have some kind of electromagnetic interference so that we actually see things as phenomena and we don't have our mental construct anymore, not modeling anymore,
yes,
we are living in this conventional world. So it is good to have knowledge of trying to find out what this is, but at the same time, we are always going to live in a conventional world. So what is the best way to do that?
Well, let's go back to your, I wouldn't, let's say it might be your preference rather than a truth that you hold dear.
Thanks.
There is no conventional world. It's, if you're reading what you're reading, your sense of the conventional world is just an abstraction. Why place so much value on the conventional world? Why raise a flag to it? Why be loyal to it?
Because I like to have the money to come to Andres and sit with you and he pays and stuff on the platter.
Yeah, but
I live in this other
It doesn't mean it's not automatic that if you wake up to the fact that this isn't about something, you become an instant pauper.
No,
none of us be here.
Unless you're me, but I still somehow come up with breakfast.
If we don't want to be paupers,
you don't.
To become other than.
You don't know that. You see, I mean, I hear you, right? I mean, everyone hears you, but that's an arbitrary investment in constructs that don't actually rule your life or rule your consciousness. But if you sign up for them, and let's say being a pauper would suck for you, and therefore the conventional world is real, and I want to live in it successfully and be enlightened too, rock and roll. Apply yourself diligently. Let's hope it works out, if that's what you want.
Well, what about people that it's about evolution, I guess. There are people that are living that aren't very happy with their existence.
It's hard to say. I mean, we'd have to do a poll. It might take a while. And yes, I mean, from a socioeconomic point of view, here we are sitting in the land of kings, right? A very small percentage of the global population, chilling on good cheese and organic peppers and onions, sweet. And we know that 7.3 or 2 or whatever billion it is are not also sitting at a lovely cheese shop having breakfast where they live. That most are starving.
But we don't know how they really feel about it.
But we don't know how they feel about it. Yeah, right. And
but the Buddha had understanding that he thought that his impression was that they weren't really having much fun.
We'd have to ask him what he meant by that, if that's true.
Yeah. What, the people that were starving weren't having that much fun?
Well, just the people.
Neither Buddhism or Hinduism, Islam, Baha'i, any of the religions that came from men and women that had revelatory experiences that wanted to help, they all fucking failed. Look at us. Read the news.
Yeah.
They all failed. And the 1/10 of the 1% that are actually running the show, they failed too. You're not going to find a successful, altruistic presenter anywhere on earth. Maybe Tony Robbins.
Comic relief.
You know what I mean? And so, have humans worked it out? Clearly not. I mean, the species is in a crisis, an environmental crisis, a financial crisis, a sustainability crisis, a food crisis, an ocean crisis, a climate crisis. What, are we kidding? The Buddha didn't help. with respect to the objective of having a big, sustainable kumbaya for humanity. But maybe that's just not possible. Maybe no realizer of the nature of being can make a meaningful dent in the survivability of the species in a nice kumbaya way. We're more interested in competing with each other, right? Manipulating each other, avoiding each other, getting mad at each other, imposing our will on each other violently or otherwise.
Not interested in, but just by nature are.
Fair enough. That's right. That's what happens. So not even the great gift of realization is going to change the tide, right, of what appears on Earth. Because even Earth is an idea.
When you talk about there's, you know, you're working on a steering wheel that's connected to nothing, that whole, we don't care about other people or whatever you just said, that doesn't matter. Like, the actions and the who's actually doing it don't really matter because that steering wheel isn't connected to anything. Like your mention of Popper, what I've noticed is as I disconnect a little bit from thinking, oh, I have to do X, Y, and Z to make my life hang together and keep it going, as the more I disconnect from that, the more I discover it goes anyway. It's astonishing to me that without the, oh my gosh, I have to, it still just keeps trucking along. So it's the exploration or the noticing that the steering wheel is not connected to anything. And most of my steering wheel, my version of a steering wheel is I have to do this, I have to show up to work, I have to be on time, I got to try, all that stuff. That's the steering wheel. The reality is it not being connected to anything means for some strange reason, I'm there or I'm here or I'm doing what I do.
Yeah.
And it's just a story in my head about I'm doing it, or I have to do it, or the consequences if I don't.
The interests of humans, psychologically speaking, are absolutely arbitrary. And they're not actually responsible for anything. You know, Einstein was capable of helping us construct a weapon to flatline Japan during some kind of conflict. I don't remember exactly what they called it. And his vision was revelatory. Ask the poets, the physicists, men and women that brought forth incredible gifts of profound revelation to the species, scientifically, socially, in the arts, wherever. Most all of them are going to say, with very few holding out, like, I didn't do it. Wasn't me. It's so clear that the entirety of what we call phenomenon is absolutely doing itself, which includes the ideas, respectful ideas of the conventional forms in which we live, how we educate ourselves, care for ourselves from the point of view of hygiene, maybe attract a partner, maybe not, or at least close friends, and then either entrepreneurially create work for others or be an employee of others that have created work for you, whether you're living in the government sector or the private sector, or whether you're in the black market trading figs on the streets of Turkey. So we have all figured out, strangely, how this works. It may not last. It may collapse upon the weight of too many people, too much environmental impact, too little sustainability intelligence, too much greed, things that the Buddha and Ramakrishna and Jesus and everyone else simply could not eradicate. We're unsuccessful in eradicating these impulses from the species. So it's quite possible the species will end up muerte.
But it's not even...
But who cares?
Look how virtually impossible it is to do a good deed. You really can't. The ripple effect will always benefit some people and possibly destroy civilizations. Every time you make a vaccine, okay, you're helping some people, but you're probably killing a whole way of life. I mean, so what the Buddha or even Christ intended was never possible. You know, it just was never going to happen. Because you're not dealing with anything that's real that you can hang on to.
And I would also question that their intention coming from the atmosphere of revelation that they were hanging out in had anything to do with making Earth a better place to live. It could have been a lot more pedestrian than that. Like, hey, Phil, you got to check this shit out. It's unbelievable.
That's more like
it. I think it was more like that. Hey, Bonnie, this is fucked. You really got to see this. I think it was just like that. All of this, altruism, global altruism that we accuse the Buddha of, may be a total lie. That's all. And, you know, in the writings...
On his level.
That's right. In the writings, his first impulse was, fuck me, no one's going to believe this. No one will understand this. Because he went through the membrane through no will of his own. The call it the conditioning or the myth of referentiality. He burst the bubble on what this is or isn't. And was like... Oh, no one's going to get this. I'm fucked.
So why do they do it? Why do, like, Christ and Buddha and other teachers, why do they pour their whole life into trying to share it?
They didn't know. Why should we?
Well, but think about if you experience a kind of bliss, the natural state is to want to share it.
Good luck. What do flowers do? Check this out.
Yeah, exactly.
Check it out.
I'm blue.
Yeah, really. Really? Really? Yeah.
And then it starts
right here.
All kinds of real subtle things to attract things. Like, come here, bees.
Yes.
Land on this thing.
What are those? What are those fun floral arrangements that are carnivorous?
Oh, edible arrangements.
No, the ones that eat stuff.
Venus flytrap.
Yeah. Well, there's several, but maybe the most well known.
Yes.
But it's like,
plants.
Check me out. Aren't I the shit in you? Right? I mean, it folds down, keeps the fly from escaping, and then the enzymes within the body of the flower eat the fly.
Well, some of them actually keep the little guys alive in there and then release them so they can go germinate other things.
Yeah.
So they hold them prisoner for a little bit.
Okay.
And then let them go.
Okay. Nice.
That's the Borg philosophy.
Seasonal germination. You're on house arrest. This is too weird. We all know from first-hand experience that the loyalty that we place in the conventionality of getting through the life is profound, conditioned. You could also say that we have kind of a love-hate relationship with it. We're angry by having to suffer the profound schizophrenia. Sorry. Of having to suffer the profound schizophrenia of instinctively knowing this is unencumbered and then still having to apply ourselves, right, in a competitive kind of way. The human psyche is twisted and unhappy because its profound instinct is the instinct of the Buddha. But it also finds itself having to compromise its own affection and intelligence to do good in the conventional level.
Human beings is the pack mentality and the sense of community, and therefore compassion becomes the mammals, and animals give birth to a lot of young, and therefore they care for the young, and therefore that's part of human.
Maybe. You won't find a cause for that. You won't find a meaning. We're observing the bizarritude of life appearing on Earth and then coming up with what we think are plausible ideas that we might be able to convince ourselves or somebody else of. But nobody knows what's going on here. Nobody knows what mammal is, what human is, what the instincts are, why we behave the way that we behave.
But there do seem to be trends. I mean, evolution does seem to, in the way that conventional way that we view it and study it.
There's a
series of events, and I mean, not that it explains this, but
it's
happening on top of this.
Well, the series of events that you and I might like to look at in the history books are myths. All that actually occurs is the irrefutability of your present experience. That's all that occurs, and that's all that has ever occurred. This is too much fun.
It's like an organism.
Here, we'll set him on. Okay, thank you.
What fun.
Oh, boy.
Thank you.
Wow.
We have to add.
We got two trays?
I don't like it. Yeah, I'm never supposed to take it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to eat all that.
This is amazing. You need to clear it so that there's more room for other stuff.
Oh, I need some bacon.
Or I'm going to die.
The Buddha says so.
Oh, this is cut up naan.
What is it?
Huh. Naan.
We need bigger plates for some of these little things.
I know.
Yeah, we definitely need bigger plates.
Yeah.
And why did he give his finger plates?
I don't know.
Perception.
Size of the table. Yeah. You're really
good. Yeah, that's true.
You didn't get any bacon? Or you already ate it? The fruity.
I'll put it under something. Yeah, I'm going to just put it. Okay.
Just throw food on the table.
Another round of coffee at your leisure. You got it, buddy.
Take your time.
With knowledge of all we're discussing,
yeah.
How does one live?
Just the way you always have.
I think you notice that it's being lived.
It's doing it.
I mean, I have some potatoes. I didn't. Yeah.
It's doing it already. How have you done it so far? Mm-hmm. You don't actually know.
Yeah.
It's true.
But we do have choice, and we can.
No.
No.
You don't have any choice. No, choice is a myth. That's what the physicists are saying. I mean, the Buddha said it too, but, you know, if you feel like paying attention to the physicists instead of the Buddha, go there. There's no choice. This is really, 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 really doing itself. You want me to hold it?
Mm-hmm.
Completely.
Well, I'll give you an example. I recently visited my brother in Colorado.
All right.
And, you know, it's a wonderful environment. And I felt really fantastic. I've been there many times.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking about moving there.
Sweet.
So that's a choice. I mean, still moment to moment, my life isn't going to change. But
no, the fact that you went there was not a choice. The experiences you had there had nothing to do with choice.
And what about the decision I'm going to make?
If you move there, you'll move there. That doesn't mean you made a decision.
Whenever you get a chance, I'll remind a little bit.
Not really.
How did anything happen? How is this happening? How do you digest food? How do you see light? How do you hear sound? Why does the sun kind of hang out where it hangs out and we revolve around it? By choice? Did someone make a choice?
Have you ever noticed them falling through your life?
I want somebody.
You couldn't stop them. Or if you're trying to make something happen, you can't make it happen.
Choice is spelled SUFFERING.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
FFERING?
Suffering.
Suffering. SU.
Yes.
The SU.
Fuffering.
I hate this fuffering, all this fuffering that I'm doing.
With the heightened awareness, whatever that is.
Yeah, whatever it is.
Whatever it is. Somehow things can seem to be more connected or streamlined or go better. I mean, again, I know you can say that's all subjective and it's happening, but
didn't happen for Jesus.
No.
Didn't work out for him too well.
No.
Hey, I'm enlightened. You're on a cross.
But he was trying to make sure.
Hey, I see God. Here's a nail for your head.
Just some
thorn.
Right? Dave, can you
pass
me down the
cream? I'm feeling really, really good about the divine. Oh, here's a spear in your ribs. Yeah. No, it doesn't. This can go any which way. If you look at the promise of something like realization as being advantageous to your life, then you remain in suffering. Yeah. Here's what mind does. Mind makes it appear as if something happened before this moment, and as if something is going to happen hence. For instance, a decision to move to Colorado. But let's look at the secular fact of being. We'll take the physicists off the table. We'll take Buddha off the table. This is our laboratory, right here. Right? So the first level of sobriety is right here, right now, has to be the laboratory for our discovery. Otherwise, we just remain in deferral and abstraction and insanity for the long haul. Right? Good. So here this is. And even that's saying too much. Nobody knows what this is, the genesis, where it's occurring, how, why, to whom. Irrefutability is so. That's all we can really say about it with any confidence, and even that's suspect. Look at the present moment, which is, you could say, one's experience is made up of a kind of a streaming, right, of presence. How long does each moment last? Well, it has no duration. None. You have memory, but is your recollection of things that happened before this moment actual or representational? Right? Memory is representational. When memory occurs, you can have current experience. You could have joy, you could have sorrow, you could have fear, you could have impulse, you could have agreement or disagreement. You might make a phone call, you might write a letter, do some step work. Right? You might go out drinking. So things occur, you could say, in the plasma of present experience, which appear to be inspired by memory. But what you're remembering is unreal. Your plans for the future, like moving to Colorado, are likewise unreal. I'm not saying it's a bad move. Sounds good. We're all coming. But it's unreal. The Buddha's revelation was not, how can I improve my life? Or how can I improve life on earth after I've witnessed so much old age, sickness, and death, right? Sorrow and lamentation. It had nothing to do with that. All that happened to the Buddha was like, oh, fuck me. This is all there is. Oh, God.
What about for the benefit of all sentient beings? I mean, that's like a pretty famous Buddha.
I don't know if he said it. You know what? They might have stitched that stuff into the Pali Canon, so that to make they might have stitched that into the Pali Canon to make the Buddha look like as if he cared, because it would have been too weird to sell a god, an accomplished god, to the population who actually didn't give a shit.
Well, he was just going around sharing. Somebody else put it all together.
Yeah. Yeah, he was doing this. He was sitting around having breakfast and going, hey, Bob, this is unbelievable. That's it.
That's all he did.
Yeah.
And then the scribe said, this isn't going to sell.
No, this is going to sell. We have to modify this.
Well, that's what they did with the gospel.
Same thing. Yeah. Now, if we look at, again, a secular observation, that the only thing that's actual, and I don't mean to place a lot of emphasis on actual, I'm just using actual to say, this is irrefutable. What memory refers to is fantasy, though memory occurs within the presence of irrefutability, right? planning occurs within the presence of irrefutability. But what planning is pointing out is fantasy. Right? This, right here, right now, this is it. Right here. Now, it's not that difficult to pretend that this is doing itself. What's happening right now, and in all of the meticulous beauty, just at the table of what, however many people we are, this is unbelievable. Just this, within these few square feet of space, is like, you got to be kidding me. Completely off the charts. But we don't have any sensitivity to that. Or let's say we've lost sensitivity to that. Because we live referentially. We live in ideas. We live in fantasy. We live in the past. We live in the future. We live actually in fantasy. We don't know how to live, let's say, consciously in the present. That's why the be here now stuff, you know, got very popular, right? Be here now, which is a little too pedestrian, because there's not really a now nor a here. In other words, you can't occupy this because you've never been separate from this. And so the collapse of the presumption that you exist separately from the entirety, that could be useful. The collapse of the presumption that you are separate from this, you could say, leads to greater, you know, call it joy, greater mystery. Does it have any utility? Maybe. If you were given a choice between living in fantasy and living in the joy of present being, if you were given the choice, you might say, joy of present being, I'll take joy of present being. But not everyone would make that choice. You know, like the Matrix, the red pill and the blue pill.
It's not really possible to
do it. Do what?
To live in the present.
Well,
because of the way our mind works.
No, that's not why it's impossible. No, it's impossible because it's a fabrication of idea. Hell yeah. We got a hell yeah over here. There is no mind. There is no mind. There is the conflagration of experience.
Dude, keep it.
I don't know.
I'll
keep
it.
So it's a question of identity. You or any of us as a being that insists on being the consequence of something, like birth, like Big Bang, like mind, like body, right? If you insist that your present experiencing, the conflagration of present experiencing, is the consequence of something, then you're separate, right? You're an extrusion, you're a symptom, right? Yeah. But what if this, just as it is, including the majestic beauty of your present experience of it, is not the consequence of anything? Then you are source, then you are sovereign, then you are radiantly so. That's what the Buddha found out. Whoa, I'm radiantly so. There was no more intervention, no more arbitration. Thank you, sir. It's delicious.
Yeah, it was.
I think I'm good.
Yeah,
anybody else want more?
Mushrooms.
May I say, you make the best potatoes and vegetables
potatoes
I've ever
really
had.
Good,
oh, my God.
Yeah. Potatoes wrapped in ham. That's my favorite.
I know.
Mushrooms.
So what you're saying is this isn't even reliant on ham?
Yeah, there's vegetables.
Oh, my God. What terrible mood.
Mushrooms and a pepper?
You really
yeah.
are, Chuck and Johnny.
Yeah, there you go.
God damn it.
You can discover
anybody for that?
Through, let's just call it association and call it practice. That,
excuse me.
What appears in you as reference or source or consequence of anything is a fabrication. But that you are so, that this is irrefutably so, is not a fabrication. So realization, you could say, is a very, very simple crossing over. On this side, the samsaric side, referential living is what appears to be true. referential living is why the Buddha said life is suffering when you're living referentially.
Right.
Suffering is caused by desire or the conflict of aversion and attraction, because you're one is constantly pushed around. Living referentially, one is constantly pushed around. Being constantly pushed around, there's no ease. That was, yeah. You could say that was his perspective, or at least the interpreter's perspective.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is really about methodology. In order to become more aware of this, do you, talking about it the way, I can go for weeks maybe without studying anything or trying to have something in my brain to help me realize that this is all there is. And if you're not sort of stimulating your brain to be aware of that,
right,
that you are kind of lulled into this other life.
You get lulled, don't you?
In your case, Jeff, is discussion your way of being constantly reminding yourself of to live with the concept of this?
Well, before we go and talk about the myth of my experience, let's understand that there's not two things here. We, conversationally, it's useful to look at samsara as referential confusion and nirvana as the release from referential confusion. But they are non-stop, concomitantly so. Always. Yep. We can see how deeply whatever this is or isn't proliferates. Like the flower, or genocide, for instance. Right? This proliferates. Being lulled back into symptom. It's not difficult to do, is it? Samsara has a kick, doesn't it?
You have to make an effort.
Maybe. You could say an inspiration arises within you quite organically that you start paying attention to. It's a little softer than effort, but something must occur that the miracle of you starts paying attention to the miracle of you in a, you could say, more subtle manner, more curious manner, discoverable manner, right? Yeah, so that shows up. That appears in one's experience. Well, if it doesn't, it doesn't. At least not then. Yeah, at least not that moment when one is lulled. But even that's not quite true, because being lulled appears within the nirvanic field. Even being lulled is not shy of realization, is not shy of nirvana. It's the curious nature of present experience, how you experience it, and or how you frame it, or what you tell yourself about your present experience.
Right, so any conception that we presume about awake or about nirvana or about some better state is simply that.
That's right. It's just an arbitrary notion. Yeah.
You know, there's a whole lot of suffering that comes about just from thinking we're not there, or that this isn't there. That seems to be really the
problem. And also, nothing is ever solved. There's no resolution. Just so many times, you're trying to put together in your head something that will work, and nothing does.
Well, I know this is just a theory. I'm going to say this is just a theory, but as human beings, we have developed something, we want to describe it as ego, and that's what drives us, and and it has to do with the creating and continuing our species. And that's a big part of what drives us and why we have this idea of our ship to this. And that is a part of us. Yes, right. And that's where it all comes from. Competitiveness, the conflict, it's all from thinking we are a self, and we are a self, and it drives us. So, I mean, that's a theory.
It was a good one.
Yeah.
I like it.
Because we do like explanations. And that's one way to explain it.
This is very unruly. Because it's not caused. So everything that appears at the level of complexity of the primate experience, the level of complexity at the humpback whale experience, the dolphin experience, the grasshopper, the tick, the deer's ass, whom the tick may be sucking from, is, you got to be kidding me. And all explanation, which merely means the assertion of language memes as ideation, is empty of self nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, if you or any of us are driven in a constructive way for explanations or connections or cross-pollination amongst religious ideas, knock yourself out. What could be more fun? It's not true. It's not defining. It's not causative. But that doesn't mean you can't have a blast dwelling in the thrill of ideation.
Well, if you stepped out and you could study the behavior of human beings, you could come up with a theory.
We have. look how successful all the theories have been. Mm-hmm. Everyone had a theory. Hitler had a theory. Who was that? Mother Teresa had a theory. Right?
And ISIS has a theory.
Amici has a theory. Ramdas has a theory. Not a very good one because, you know, half his mind was gone in the stroke. He has kind of a blurry theory.
Might be a more pleasant way of living, though.
Might be.
He surely sees things differently.
Being bankrolled by Wayne Dyer is nice. If I could be bankrolled by Wayne Dyer, I would consider it. Maybe not at the expense of a stroke, but it's not up to me. So, what's present is not what, nor can you say what it is or isn't, nor can you theorize successfully as to why it is, where it is, how it came about, where it's going, what the consequences are. You can't even say with any confidence what's occurring in your present experience. You can do so abstractly through hypotheticals, through imagination, and slinging a bunch of language around, which I can be easily accused of, right? But where does it leave you? Nowhere. But still, oh, this. Well, this never quits.
Well, getting back to the question, a bit more, maybe more personal.
Yeah.
How to be aware
of it.
I mean, how to live that way.
Right.
There's green and goat cheese. And what would you bring in?
Well,
did not? You finished
this?
That's a great question. Who knows? It happens.
But you found that.
Well, let's look at it this way.
Conversation and thinking about it and writing about it.
Well, you found for the years that you were involved in, right? What is it? Shrin Rin Namyoho Renge Kyo Buddhism, right? That was a way that nourished you, right? And maybe you're still doing that, or maybe you're not doing it so much anymore, or it's just not nourishing you in the same way that it once did.
But it wasn't about this and living now. It was it talked about the fabrications of the past and the future, and that's part of what made me turn away from it, because I realized that a lot of what was in the theory was not
true.
Yeah, well, right.
It wasn't really directing me to here.
No. That's why you abandon it. That's how this works. At some, you could say, stage of your miraculous life, you were inoculated by suspicion. Being inoculated by suspicion is the same thing as saying is, it's likely you have an appointment to keep with realization. That's what it means. If you've been inoculated by suspicion, that would suggest you have an appointment to keep with realization. Now go have fun. Find it. Make the discovery. Apply yourself. Get lulled. Get high. Take ayahuasca. Jump off a cliff. Live. Die. Succeed. Fail. What doesn't matter? There's no how.
The impetus will be there regardless of the circumstances.
That's right. Is there anything in the attraction to move to Colorado which has to do with satisfying your aspiration?
I just feel energized.
Where
I'm going to might move. Is it 8,000 feet? The Rockies go up another 6,000 feet. The air is clear. It's just
wonderful.
Let's go. Feeling moment to moment is just
very, very cool. There you go. That's it. The feeling from moment to moment is what assists you
to clear away of itself.
In the unfolding of the realization of what this is or isn't.
I find it clearer more and more away, so it's more basic living.
Basic living is another, you could say, useful accoutrement of your awareness turning more affectionately toward itself without being distracted.
And it's also giving up a lot of convenience. But I guess it's sort of an experiment. I sort of want to, because I think there's a dependency when it comes to all this interesting stimulation.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a way to channel something more direct.
Yeah. We'll see.
We'll see. Could be the biggest mistake of my life.
Not possible.
Not possible.
Colorado can be
mistake.
Other things might be, but
I mean, there's nothing there. I mean, just
staying can't be a mistake either.
That's what Colorado has to teach you. There's nothing there.
Or there's less there than here.
Not
it's
really.
More direct.
I mean, I get it. I mean, I would say what you're attracted to is a vital relationship with uncluttered and non-pretentious being. That's what you love. That's how this drives any of us to discover what this is or isn't. That's what you love. So if Colorado, as a pristine alpine environment, touches, inspires that recognition in you, then it could easily turn into a desire to be in that physical place. But what you're aiming for is not Colorado. What you're aiming for is revelation of self.
It's an energy. I mean, it's just something you feel.
That's what revelation of self is. It is an energy. It's something that you feel.
I've spent a lot of time with Byron Katie around LAX. Like, that environment gets really attractive when you've done that. It's kind of funny. Like, the smell of exhaust and big buildings and trash and fire plugs and stuff. It's like, oh, man, that looks really good. It's because... Yeah. For me, it doesn't really matter. You spend enough time in seemingly altered states in a particular environment that wouldn't be like this pristine, lovely. All of a sudden, that looks amazing, like power lines. I remember just laughing hysterically at a fire plug. It was the funniest thing I've ever seen. It was funny. It had like funny ears and a nose and hysterical laugh. It wasn't the environment. It was just what I was seeing at the time.
Near Sagadatta was uncluttered in the middle of Bombay.
It doesn't matter.
Smoking cigarettes.
No, if you want to go,
I'm not moving again.
I
you can do it anywhere.
I went to Prescott, Arizona for 12 years, which has the same pristine air and all that. And the first couple of years, it worked in that spiritual sense.
Go cheese.
Then I just got bored.
Help you go in?
Sure did. I mean, it changed my life completely. I mean, yeah, I was a lot younger than I am now, but I still got bored and I came back.
Your nature is already perfectly pristine, unencumbered, and nothing can impose upon it. It's like Dorothy in the shoes. You mean I could have always gone to Kansas? Yes, Dorothy, you could have. Yeah, that's what we're doing here. So right now, Colorado may show up as red shoes. I would go. I'm going to leave him today. But it might be, you know, useful to see that it was the feeling that told you the truth about being. And if for a time, Colorado, or for the rest of your natural life, Colorado is the hermitage of choice, pack and run. No question. But you can see that feeling of uncluttered availability is what this is. Oh, that was easy.
So then the question is, how to do it? Right.
Well, sure. But it's interesting. Even the how to do it where I am creates a fuzzy ball of nonsense that you subscribe to out of convenience, joy, or deferral that convinces you that this is what's right here, right now, is not where you want to be. But sometime in your future, maybe with the help of Colorado, you'll be where you want to be. Yeah. So this conversation is, in a sense, myth-busting. What's the most poignant myth? Well, it's whatever myth you're holding right now, right? And if you're holding a myth right now that I'm interested in this stuff, I'd like to discover more and more fruition in my own experience. But I'm not there yet, or I need another inoculation, or I have a how-to. You see, those are presently streaming ideas which clutter your capacity to feel what this already is. That's when this becomes, let's say, less pedagogical and more intimate. Because the work, if there's any work, and not to plagiarize or get sued by Byron Katie, because she'll do it. She'll sue you. The work is to have fun exploring that this already is what you know that it is, or would hope someday that it would be. It already is exactly what you're on, what you're in search of. So the myth busting permits an encounter to become very intimate. Because you can see that you don't know what this is, and why convince yourself of something that it is when you really don't know what it is? Like Colorado, Vermont, the Bowery. A new car, a new wardrobe, commitment to a retreat will be, right, the defining enzymatic intervention that will permit me to feel that this is already what it is, You see? Mm-hmm. All of these myths occur in the seeker's journey. I mean, all movies and all books and all art and everything is, in a sense, expressive of, right? The beatitude of the journey and the beatitude of the revelation.
It's actually a convenient procrastination. I'll be happy when, the whole I'll be happy when, I'll get to where I think I need to get to bed. It lives constantly. And it's the sister of this is not enough.
Mm-hmm. They're the same. That's right. So you can apply yourself in a manner of speaking because you are already of the nature of revelatory intelligence to cut through any voice that may turn this into a reference. Living in as referencelessness is already what this is.
Unconditioned.
Come on in, the water's fine. With that perspective, I'm not saying what's real or not, because I don't know. We're just playing with, you know, perspectives and feeling and the dynamism of hanging out this way. From that perspective, one can become more adroit, playfully and affectionately adroit at seeing myth arising and then how we sign up. So mindfulness, if it's working, is a platform by which you can observe hysteria, anecdotal hysteria, pour in.
And dispel me.
That's what you're, yeah. And even dispel is not quite accurate.
Blow up?
Well, it's stranger than that. Because myth does not need to be blown up, destroyed, or even transcended. Let's say all of this, all of that's occurring as present experience, sensually and or otherwise, is 100% myth. But it's also irrefutable. Myth is nirvana. That's complete identity. If I want to blow up, transcend, or eradicate myth, I'm separate. The collapse of separate is myth's cool. I'm good with myth. Now what happens is this kind of knot of being other than, meaning therefore being other than and suffering, I want to eradicate the symptoms, the consequences, the reasons for the suffering. But you still stay, right? The monkey puts his hand through the wooden thing, grabs a fruit, and now he's trapped. He will not let go of the fruit to remove his hand. That's us. That's how mind plays. It reaches through, grabs the fruit. It will not let go of the fruit and remains trapped by its own hand, by its own fist. So all that's appearing is myth. Simply, I'm not saying whether it's real or unreal. I don't know if it's real or unreal. I don't know what this is. Who? Show me who has the authority to say that this is real or unreal. Who has the authority to say that this is actual or imaginary? Nobody. No one. So we're using myth just as a device, as an embrace. All that's appearing, including the sovereignty of your own experience, is of the nature of myth. That doesn't mean good, bad, or that needs to be transcended or eradicated. It's just an embrace. All is myth. Myth happens to be of the nature of divine revelation. They're not two. Now there's nothing to fight with. There's nothing to accomplish or no place to get to other than right here and right now. Because this is the entirety of irrefutable nirvanic expansivity presenting as proliferation of myth.
What is regret?
Regret's nice to have if you could find some.
Is that a story too?
Isn't it? Isn't it? Without the imagination of a past, and you as the doer, decider, and chooser, you can't have regret. You have to make up two things in order to be the sufferer or enjoyer of regret. There has to be reference. I was bad. I made a wrong choice. Right? I took the wrong drug, married the wrong person, made the stupid investment. If I hadn't done all those things, I'd be wealthy, still have my hair, and, you know, be living in Colorado. Nothing is true. Nothing is true. That this is irrefutable happens to be nirvana. But everything appearing in it is not true. Pretty much that simple.
I just thought of an interesting experiment. You find two people that are absolutely convinced that they're Jesus and put them in the same room to have to work it out.
Yeah.
And that's us sometimes when we're in conflict with one idea and another.
Yeah.
Not that I ever thought of it.
Try it.
I certainly have at times these conflicting dances in my life.
All that's appearing in mind, in sensation, in body, in the enjoyment of memory, the suffering of memory, the thrill of the future, the denial and apprehension of the future, is myth. But all myth is appearing here in the intimate solidity of irrefutability. That's it. This is it. This is nirvana. The entirety of nirvana. Even though what we call the human primate, living in a thin veneer, atmospheric veneer on so-called Earth, is not findable from the vantage point of the observable universe, still the sovereignty of your present experience is the entirety of all. It's just not easy to justify when you look at yourself as a physical creature, as a speck on a planet in a solar system that no one's ever heard or seen about, probably wouldn't care to visit even if they had an invitation. But still, that this is so is nirvanically the case for the entirety of all creation. That would include, let's say, a very, you know, technologically or psychically advanced extraterrestrial coming from an interdimensional wormhole that they know how to control, you know, that comes here and tips cows. Even they, with technology and consciousness beyond our wildest imagination, are nirvanically, irrefutably so. They don't have, were they to exist, and I have every reason to believe they probably do, were they to exist, they're still, right? They're still in the field. Now that's strange. That means that your present experience, as in right here and right now, is the Brahmanic and the Nirvanic entirety. You're not small. You're not separate. When you look at how it creates, you see how this creates, you won't find any will or building block with which it does all this. It's too bizarre. If you're a scientist, maybe you go in search of a findable particle or a findable cause that all of this occurs. Well, I haven't found it yet. So this is truly causeless. It's not radiating out from, so that there's no source or author or building block with which this is doing what it's doing. It's radiant in expression, but not from. It's not radiating from somewhere. Time, space, self are mythically imposed upon the nirvanic plenum. And that's what the physicist is saying. The revelation is, oh my God, this is impersonally arising. And that all pattern recognition and the filters and means through which pattern recognition and universe construction occur are absolutely arbitrary. So they're signing on to the observation that this is not self. But then he screws it up by having to
place value on it,
create utility from a human point of view. But the human point of view is arbitrary and it's made of pure myth. So why place value on anything from the human point of view when you've already said the human point of view is myth? What a jackass. Probably a lovely guy.
You do it all the time.
You see?
Daily.
That's just it. So when you,
I do say we.
When you look at the samsaric impulse, what you're seeing really is the way that this places value on its own radiant nature. This is in love with itself. So then, at least in our, what we call our minds, right, representational neocortex, where language and pure unadulterated impression can turn into a representation form, like a word, well, we just jump all over this shit. And the jumping all over this from the point of view of reference is self. That's what the myth of I, me, my, or the myth of self is about. Yes. That's right. Right.
What's interesting is, though, as I explore it, it doesn't value or devalue any aspect of it. It's just a simple recognition, in a way. It's not, therefore, I won't do it anymore.
Yeah,
therefore,
like self can be here, but you just don't have such an investment.
Yeah.
You just notice, oh,
or
yeah.
Delight in what appeared to be a choice that didn't go well, as I should learn how to choose better. I'm incredibly relieved by the fact that somehow seemed like the right thing to do at the time. Okay. All right.
Here's the, let's call it, it's a sine wave. It's lovely for us to feel relieved by certain, you know, revelatory acknowledgement, right? And the relief of the pain of choice making, the pain of regret, the pain of aspiration, of hopefulness. So at one level, talking the way we talk and feeling and seeing things the way that we play with can relieve oneself temporarily or forever, as if there were a temporarily or a forever, from the myth of self. And we typically frame any kind of, let's say, progress along the spiritual thing from the vantage point of how it may be appearing to me, in me, and pleasantly so. Right? Someone doesn't have a dark night of a soul and, you know, barely gets through and says, great spiritual experience. Right? No, that sucks. But if we have a little relief from self, from apprehension, from planning, from regret, it's like, my path's working. My path's working. So
we turned into a eulogy of some sort.
Now, and that this occurs is fine. I mean, like you said, there's the conventional so-called world. There's emotion and feeling and experience. And emotion, feeling, and experience occurring under the rubric of self hurts. So any relief we get from that hurting and a greater confidence that we might have in the delight of the day is
a blessing, his grace, no question. Well, let's go, if we can, to kind of another dimension of it. Here's this. You don't give a shit how it shows up. You don't give a fuck if you're miserable, lulled, in the shit, or fucking enlightened. You don't give a fuck goddamn exactly how this is showing up, because you know that it's myth. It's not you. It's never been you. It never can be you. No matter how it wants to play out, you're like, fine, great, got a great deal on a car, lost my shirt in the stock market.
So what you described is a knowing. So
it's weirder than knowing.
Good.
Because it's not representational.
Okay.
It's what this is now. It's what this is already, like as in right now. You are completely over the top. You're completely done with all reference and all identification and all association. Right now. You're not human, like as in right now. You are actually whatever this is or isn't, in which whatever this is or isn't appears in itself. That's not a thing, not a destination, not a source, not an origin, not even a creator.
Processor?
No. No, because there's no time.
Keep trying.
There's no time. It doesn't have enough time to process. Its capacity for revelatory expression and evaporation is a simultaneity. No identity can be found. Samsara is what appears to be locus of identity. Body, mind, self, and experiencing. And then the way we think and feel about shit, which is time and memory.
Space, like there's no space between anything here.
No.
But you can't get outside of something that you're part of.
No.
So how can you really see it?
How's this? It's already done. Samsara is simply a clever word used to suggest misidentification. Now, misidentification is maybe better said as the presence of identification. Because misidentification would suggest you got it wrong, you can get it right. You can't. So whatever this is or isn't also renders itself to itself with no identification whatsoever. Right now. This has no identification. Not with itself, not with anything. All reference, all imaginary boundary or borders between experience and to whom that experience may be occurring is absolutely gone. Training part is valuable to inventory the myth. The training part is only valuable to inventory the myth so that you can see, oh, fuck, all I've got is myth. That's how the training, training is that. It's the observation that all that's appearing is myth. Yes. So this has the capacity of keeping an eye on itself as it's doing what it's doing. Because the brain doesn't know the brain. Consciousness doesn't know consciousness. The absolute doesn't know the... I mean, you know, right? Who or what is it that's sitting behind all of this that can say, this is irrefutable? We don't know. It's not the brain. The brain is meat. High quality meat. Good cut. Very fatty. what if the feeling that's here, I'm not talking sentiment, right? This is so. How do you know that this is so? You don't even know how you know that this is so. By saying, because there is sensation, because there's the five senses, because there's thought, because there's brain, I think, therefore I am. None of that's true. All constructs. We don't even know how we can say this is so. And yet, the irrefutability doesn't quit, does it? You haven't, let's say, practically blinked out of existence, never to be seen or heard from again. So if you had a lot of debt, that might be a good thing. So that's what we're looking at. We're simply giving attention to that this is so, with the appreciation is that we don't know how we know that this is so. That's a different quality of paying attention to your present experience than dwelling in rumination and abstraction. You don't know anything, and nor will you ever. That's the good news. As you journey into feeling that this is so, with the keen appreciation that you don't know how you know that it's so, you could say you're present, attentive to the texture of being, not to the rumination. You're present and attentive to the nature, to the texture of being. Oh, whoa! This shit bees, man. As you get comfortable and return involuntarily or apparently voluntarily to appreciating the texture of being, you'll discover that your experience becomes punctuated with non-identity.
But it's still a construct.
It's what?
It's still a construct.
No. No.
I mean, everything, our brain is...
No, not this is not brain. We're not talking brain. No, no, that's not the case. You see, that's you thinking you know how you know this is so. You don't know how you know that this is so. This irrefutability is not the consequence of brain. Nor body. Brain and body are ideas appearing as perfume. They're not causal. You can feel how awareness tied to symptoms becomes referential. The game plan for these conversations is feel awareness non-referentially. No, it's not. It's just this. The ideas clutter it. The referentiality through ideas of self clutter your already pristine appreciation that you don't know how you know this is so. So it's not hard to do. That's a mistake. It's a myth. No. No. Don't lift a finger. Your discovery is, your challenge is to see what's already the case. Not a how-to. It's not as the result of a process.
Different channel?
No, same channel.
Same channel?
Yeah. Same channel. Is this LSD?
I'll take the whole container.
If there's a utility of hanging out in this kind of way more than once,
It's to practically play with the invitation to feel this without being pushed around by rumination. Well, because it can, because samsara and nirvana are not two. We can use words, but that doesn't mean I have to believe in them. Okay, we communicate. We're communicating verbally, non-verbally, right? Orally, right? We're hanging. We're kicking back. Words don't really interfere with it. Another way of playing with it is, how do you feel or notice the most profound confidence that you have? And the most profound confidence that you have is not about, right, circumstances and events. It's about that this is so. That being, or suchness, whatever you feel like that day, is so. Irrefutability. Right? What do you borrow from for that confidence to be present? Look there. That confidence is not an event. It's dynamic. The confidence of being happens to be presently appearing in or as the confidence of being. It's not the consequence of anything. That's weird. Lovely. So as we play around with, being attentive to, and affectionate with, the unearned confidence of being as being in being, it's revelatory. It transmutes. That's really... We spend how much time in daydreaming with no effort? No one says, oh, daydreaming's really hard, man. I went to a daydreaming workshop, you know? Because, like, I was too fucking present, you know? And I was like, they were showing me how to, like, make shit up. Man, I had to get out of there.
It's so funny that we clearly have nighttime dreaming and daytime dreaming, yet we, like, why is it so hard to make believe that all this is dreaming? You know what I mean? It's like, really? Is that that big of a deal? I mean, is it really that different? You've made some arbitrary day and nighttime dreaming.
It's just as easy to feel this without identity as it is to daydream.
So when we're born,
you were not born. And even if we look at, you know, biological replication, how to assign conditioning or no conditioning is an impossibility. No one knows what to say. The atheists might say one thing, and the Christians might say another, and the Baha'i might say another, and ISIS might say another, Richard Dawkins might say something, Sam Harris might say something, Deepak Chopra probably would have something to say. So what? Feeling this without any identity whatsoever is as easy as daydreaming. Which certainly puts the kibosh on all the money changing hands for spiritual seekers to get somewhere. Now, since we could say have been conditioned that daydreaming is our default position. It might be worthwhile to find a few people where you can consciously, affectionately, without having to defend yourself, see how easy it is to feel what you're feeling without identity. It's just not commonly expressed in the culture, in the so-called conventional culture. That doesn't mean it's not so. It's just, you can say, practically speaking, it's not so easy to find. But once you find it, once you find either that texture in yourself or in the company of others, then it's likely you would be drawn to participate in it so that you could play around with feeling what this feels like when you have no identity. And that's always curiously been the case. When you look at the secret societies that have always punctuated the primate experience. Let's say you, it's a kind of a passing on, as was the Buddha's inclination, right? The passing on of a quality of revelation to those that were interested in hearing it. Playing around with it. Right. Discovering that it's their own. That's all.
Don't figure it out without me. Just gonna let you
know. Okay. Nice to meet you.
Have fun today, guys. You're going to be fun. I'm having a good time.